Disc 8.
Chapter 31. Zurich. Herr Christian Zigerli, Special Events Coordinator at the Dolder Grand Hotel, was a good deal like the hotel itself. Dignified and pompous, resolute and understated, a man who enjoyed his lofty perch in life because it allowed him to look down his nose at others. He was also a man who did not care for surprises. As a rule, he required 72 hours advance notice for special bookings and conferences, but when Hella Enterprises and Systec Wireless expressed a desire to conduct their final merger negotiations at the Dolder, Herr Zigerli agreed to waive the 72-hour provision in exchange for a 15% surcharge. He could be accommodating when he chose to be, but accommodation, like everything else at the Dolder, came at a steep price. Hella Enterprises was the suitor, so Hella handled the booking arrangements. Not old man Rudolf Hella himself, of course, but a glossy Italian personal assistant who called herself Elena. Herr Zigerli tended to form opinions about people quickly. He would tell you that any hotelier worth his weight in sand did. He did not care for Italians in general, and the aggressive and demanding Elena quickly earned a high ranking on his long list of unpopular clients. She spoke loudly on the telephone, a capital crime in his estimation, and seemed to believe that the mere act of spending vast amounts of her master's money entitled her to special privileges. She did seem to know the hotel well. Odd, since Herr Zigerli, who had a memory like a file cabinet, could not recall her ever being a guest at the Dolder. And she was excruciatingly specific in her demands. She wanted 4 adjoining suites near the terrace overlooking the golf course, with good views of the lake. When Zigerli informed her that this was not possible, 2 and 2, or 3 and 1, but not 4 in a row, she asked whether guests could be moved to accommodate her. "Sorry," said the hotelier, "but the Dolder Grand is not in the habit of turning guests into refugees." She settled for 3 adjoining suites and a 4th farther down the hall. "The delegations will arrive at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," she said. "They'd like a light working lunch." There followed 10 more minutes of bickering over what constituted a light working lunch. When the menu was complete, Elena lobbed 1 more demand his way. She would arrive 4 hours before the delegations, accompanied by Hella's chief of security, in order to inspect the rooms. Once the inspections were complete, no hotel personnel would be allowed inside unless accompanied by Hella security. Herr Zigerli sighed heavily and agreed, then hung up the phone, and with his office door closed and locked, performed a series of deep breathing exercises to calm his nerves. The morning of the negotiations dawned grey and cold. The stately old turrets of the Dolder poked into the blanket of freezing fog, and the perfect asphalt in the front drive shone like polished black granite. Herr Zigerli stood watch in the lobby, just inside the sparkling glass doors, feet shoulder-width apart, hands at his sides, girded for battle. "She'll be late," he thought. "They always are. She'll need more sweets. She'll want to change the menu. She'll be perfectly horrible." A black Mercedes sedan glided into the drive and stopped outside the entrance. Herr Zigerli cast a discreet glance at his wristwatch. 10 o'clock precisely. Impressive. The bellman opened the rear door, and a sleek black boot emerged. "Bruno Magli," noted Zigerli, followed by a shapely knee and thigh. Herr Zigerli rocked forward onto the balls of his feet and smoothed his hair over his bald spot. He had seen many beautiful women float through the famous doorway of the Dolder Grand, yet few had done it with any more grace or style than the lovely Elena of Hella Enterprises. She had a mane of chestnut hair, held in place by a clasp at the nape of her neck, and skin the color of honey. Her brown eyes were flecked with gold, and they seemed to grow lighter when she shook his hand. Her voice, so loud and demanding over the telephone line, was now soft and thrilling, as was her Italian accent. She released his hand and turned to an unsmiling companion. "Herr Zigerli, this is Oscar. Oscar does security." Apparently, Oscar had no last name, None needed, thought Zigerli. He was built like a wrestler, with strawberry blonde hair and faint freckles across his broad cheeks. Herr Zigerli, trained observer of the human condition, saw something he recognized in Oscar. A fellow tribesman, if you will. He could picture him 2 centuries earlier in the clothing of a woodsman, pounding along a pathway through the black forest. Like all good security men, Oscar let his eyes do the talking, and his eyes told Herr Zigerli he was anxious to get to work.
"I'll show you to your rooms," said the hotelier. "Please, follow me."
Herr Zigerli decided to take them up the stairs, rather than the elevator. They were one of the Dolder's finest attributes, and Oscar, the woodsman, didn't look like the type who enjoyed waiting for lifts when there was a flight of steps to be scaled. The rooms were on the 4th floor. On the landing, Oscar held out his hand for the electronic card keys.
"We'll take it from here, if you don't mind. No need to show us the inside of the rooms. We've all been in hotels before."
A knowing wink, a genial pat on the arm.
"Just point us the way. We'll be fine." "Indeed you will," thought Zigerli.
Oscar was a man who inspired confidence in other men. Women, too, Zigerli suspected. He wondered whether the delectable Elena, he was already beginning to think of her as his Elena, was one of Oscar's conquests. He placed the card keys in Oscar's upturned palm and showed them the way. Herr Zigerli was a man of many maxims. A quiet customer is a contented customer, was among his most cherished, and therefore he interpreted the ensuing silence on the 4th floor as proof that Elena and her friend Oscar were pleased with the accommodations. This, in turn, pleased Herr Zigerli. He now liked making Elena happy. As he went about the rest of his morning, she remained on his mind, like the trace of her scent that had attached itself to his hand. He found himself longing for some problem, some silly complaint that would require a consultation with her. But there was nothing, only the silence of contentment. She had her Oscar now. She had no need for the special events coordinator of Europe's finest hotel. Herr Zigerli, once again, had done his job too well. He did not hear from them, or even see them, until 2 o'clock that afternoon, when they congregated in the lobby and formed an unlikely welcoming party for the arriving delegations. There was snow swirling in the front court now. Zigerli believed the foul weather only heightened the appeal of the old hotel, a safe haven from the storm, like Switzerland itself. The first limousine pulled into the drive and disgorged 2 passengers. One was Herr Rudolf Heller himself, a small, elderly man dressed in an expensive dark suit and silver necktie. His slightly tinted spectacles suggested an eye condition. His brisk, impatient walk left the impression that, in spite of his advanced years, he was a man who could take care of himself. Herr Zigerli welcomed him to the Dolder and shook the proffered hand. It seemed to be made of stone. He was accompanied by the grim-faced Herr Keppelmann. He was perhaps 25 years younger than Heller, short-cropped hair, grey at the temples, very green eyes. Herr Zigerli had seen his fair share of bodyguards at the Dolder, and Herr Keppelmann certainly seemed the type. Calm but vigilant, silent as a church mouse, sure-footed and strong. The emerald-coloured eyes were placid but in constant motion. Herr Zigerli looked at Elena and saw that her gaze was trained on Herr Keppelmann. Perhaps he was wrong about Oscar. Perhaps the taciturn Keppelmann was the luckiest man in the world. The Americans came next, Brad Cantwell and Shelby Somerset, the CEO and COO of Systech Communications Incorporated of Reston, Virginia. There was a quiet sophistication about them that Zigerli was not used to seeing in Americans. They were not overly friendly, nor were they bellowing into cell phones as they came into the lobby. Cantwell spoke German as well as Herr Zigerli, and avoided eye contact. Somerset was the more affable of the 2. The well-travelled blue blazer and slightly crumpled striped tie identified him as an Eastern preppy, as did his upper-class drawl. Herr Zigerli made a few welcoming remarks, then receded quietly into the background. It was something he did exceptionally well. As Elena led the group toward the staircase, he slipped into his office and closed the door. An impressive group of men, he thought. He expected great things to come of this venture. His own role in the affair, however minor, had been carried off with precision and quiet competence. In today's world, such attributes were of little value, but they were the coin of Herr Zigerli's miniature realm. He suspected the men of Hella Enterprises and Systec Communications probably felt exactly the same way. In central Zurich, on the quiet street near the spot where the heavy green waters of the Lemat River flow into the lake, Konrad Becker was in the process of buttoning up his private bank for the evening when the telephone on his desk purred softly. Technically, it was 5 minutes before the close of business, but he was tempted to let the machine get it. In Becker's experience, only problem clients telephoned so late in the afternoon, and his day had been difficult enough already. Instead, like a good Swiss banker, he reached for the receiver and brought it robotically to his ear. "Becker and Poul?"
"Conrad, it's Shelby Somerset. How the hell are you?"
Becker swallowed hard. Somerset was the name of the American from the CIA. At least, Somerset is what he called himself. Becker doubted very much it was his real name.
"What can I do for you, Mr. Somerset?"
"You can drop the formalities for starters, Conrad."
"And for the main course?"
"You can walk downstairs to the Talstrasse and climb in the back seat of the silver Mercedes that's waiting there."
"Why would I want to do that?"
"We need to see you."
"Where is this Mercedes going to take me?"
"Somewhere pleasant, I assure you."
"What's the dress code?"
"Business attire will be fine."
"And Conrad?"
"Yes, Mr. Somerset?"
"Don't think about playing hard to get. This is the real deal. Go downstairs, get in the car. We're watching you. We're always watching you."
"How reassuring, Mr. Somerset,"
the banker said, but the line had already gone dead. 20 minutes later, Herr Zigerli was standing at reception when he noticed one of the Americans, Shelby Somerset, pacing anxiously outside in the drive. A moment later, a silver Mercedes eased into the circle, and a small, bald figure alighted from the back seat. Polished bally loafers, a blast-proof attaché case.
"A banker,"
thought Zigerli. He'd bet his paycheck on it. Somerset gave the new arrival a hail fellow smile and a firm clap on the shoulder. The small man, despite the warm greeting, looked as though he were being led to his execution. Still, Herr Zigerli reckoned the talks were going well. The money man had arrived.
"Good afternoon, Herr Becker. Such a pleasure to see you. I'm Heller, Rudolf Heller. This is my associate, Mr. Keppelmann. The man over there is our American partner, Brad Cantwell. Obviously you and Mr. Somerset are already acquainted."
The banker blinked rapidly several times, then settled his cunning little gaze on Shamron, as if he were trying to arrive at a calculation of his net worth. He held his attaché over his genitals, in anticipation of an imminent assault.
"My associates and I are about to embark on a joint venture. The problem is, we can't do it without your help. That's what bankers do, isn't it, Herr Becker? Help launch great endeavors. Help people realize their dreams, their potential."
"It depends on the venture, Herr Heller."
"I see," Shamron said, smiling. "For example, many years ago, a group of men came to you. German and Austrian men. They wanted to launch a great endeavor as well. They entrusted you with a large sum of money and granted you the power to turn it into an even larger sum. You did extraordinarily well. You turned it into a mountain of money. I assume you remember these gentlemen. I also assume you know where they got their money."
The Swiss banker's gaze hardened. He had arrived at his calculation of Shamron's worth.
"You're Israeli, aren't you?"
"I prefer to think of myself as a citizen of the world," replied Shamron,
I reside in many places, speak the languages of many lands. My loyalty, like my business interests, knows no national boundaries. As a Swiss, I'm sure you can understand my point of view.
I understand it, Becca said, but I don't believe you for a minute.
And if I were from Israel? Shamron asked. Would this have some impact on your decision?
It would.
How so?
I don't care for Israelis, Becker said forthrightly, or Jews, for that matter.
I'm sorry to hear that, Herr Becker, but a man is entitled to his opinions, and I won't hold it against you. I never allow politics to get in the way of business. I need help for my endeavor, and you're the only person who can help me.
Becker raised his eyebrows quizzically. What exactly is the nature of this endeavor, Herr Heller?
It's quite simple, really. I want you to help me kidnap one of your clients.
I believe, Herr Heller, that the endeavor you're suggesting would be a violation of Swiss banking secrecy laws and several others.
Then I suppose we'll have to keep your involvement secret.
And if I refuse to cooperate?
Then we'll be forced to tell the world that you were the murderer's banker, that you're sitting on $2.5 billion of Holocaust loot. We'll unleash the bloodhounds of the World Jewish Congress on you. You and your bank will be in tatters by the time they're finished with you.
The Swiss banker cast a pleading look at Shelby Somerset.
We had a deal.
We still do, the lanky American drawled, but the outlines of the deal have changed. Your client is a very dangerous man. Steps need to be taken to neutralize him. We need you, Conrad. Help us clean up a mess. Let's do some good together.
The banker drummed his fingers against the attaché case. You're right. He is a dangerous man, and if I help you kidnap him, I might as well dig my own grave.
We'll be there for you, Conrad. We'll protect you.
And what if the outlines of the deal change again? Who'll protect me then?
Shamron interceded. You were to receive $100 million upon final dispersal of the account. Now, there will be no final dispersal of the account, because you're going to give all the money to me. If you cooperate, I'll let you keep half of what you were supposed to receive. I assume you can do the math, Herr Becker.
I can.
$50 million is more than you deserve. But I'm willing to let you have it, in order to gain your cooperation in this matter. A man can buy a lot of security with $50 million.
I want it in writing, a letter of guarantee.
Shamron shook his head sadly, as if to say there were some things, and you should know this better than anyone, my dear fellow, that one does not put in writing.
What do you need from me? Becker asked.
You're going to help us get into his home.
How?
You'll need to see him rather urgently concerning some aspect of the account. Perhaps some papers need to be signed, some final details in preparation for liquidation and dispersal of the assets.
And once I'm inside the house?
Your job is finished. Your new assistant will handle matters after that.
My new assistant?
Shamron looked at Gabriel. Perhaps it's time we introduced Herr Becker to his new partner.
He was a man of many names and personalities. Herr Zigerli knew him as Oscar, the chief of Heller Security. The landlord of his pied-à-terre in Paris knew him as Vincent Lafont, a freelance travel writer of Breton descent, who spent most of his time living out of a suitcase. In London, he was known as Clyde Bridges, European marketing director of an obscure Canadian business software firm. In Madrid, he was a German of independent means and a restless soul who idled away the hours in cafes and bars and travelled to relieve the boredom. His real name was Uzi Navot. In the Hebrew-based lexicon of the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service, Navot was a katza,
an undercover field operative and case officer. His territory was Western Europe. Armed with an array of languages, a roguish charm, and a fatalistic arrogance, Navot had penetrated Palestinian terrorist cells and recruited agents in Arab embassies scattered across the continent. He had sources in nearly all the European security and intelligence services, and oversaw a vast network of Sayanim, volunteer helpers recruited from local Jewish communities. He could always count on getting the best table in the grill room at the Ritz in Paris, because the maître d'hôtel was a paid informant, as was the chief of the maid staff.
Konrad Becker, meet Oskar Lange.
The banker sat motionless for a long moment, as though he had been suddenly bronzed. Then his clever little eyes settled on Shamron, and he raised his hands in an inquiring gesture.
What am I supposed to do with him?
You tell us. He's very good, our Oscar.
Can he impersonate a lawyer?
With the right preparation, he could impersonate your mother.
How long does this charade have to last?
5 minutes, maybe less.
When you're with Ludwig Vogel, 5 minutes can seem like an eternity.
So I've heard,
Shamron said.
What about Klaus?
Klaus?
Vogel's bodyguard?
Shamron smiled. Resistance had ended. The Swiss banker had joined the team. He now swore allegiance to the flag of Herr Heller and his noble endeavor.
He's very professional, Becker said. I've been to the house a half dozen times, but he always gives me a thorough search and asks me to open my briefcase. So if you're thinking about trying to get a weapon into the house...
Shamron cut him off.
We have no intention of bringing weapons in the house.
Klaus is always armed.
You're sure?
A Glock, I'd say.
The banker patted the left side of his chest.
Wears it right there. Doesn't make much of an effort to hide it.
A lovely piece of detail, Herr Becker.
The banker accepted the compliment with a tilt of his head.
Details are my business, Herr Heller.
Forgive my insolence, Herr Heller, but how does one actually kidnap someone who's protected by a bodyguard, if the bodyguard is armed and the kidnapper isn't?
Herr Vogel is going to leave his house voluntarily.
A voluntary kidnapping?
Becker's tone was incredulous. How unique! And how does one convince a man to allow himself to be kidnapped voluntarily? Shamron folded his arms.
Just get Oscar inside the house, and leave the rest to us.
Chapter 32. Munich. It was an old apartment house in the pretty little Munich district of Lehel, with a gate on the street, and the main entrance off a tidy courtyard. The lift was fickle and indecisive, and more often than not, they simply climbed the spiral staircase to the third floor. The furnishings had a hotel room anonymity. There were two beds in the bedroom, and the sitting room couch was a davenport. In the storage closet were four extra cots. The pantry was stocked with non-perishable goods, and the cabinets contained place settings for eight. The sitting room windows overlooked the street, but the blackout shades remained drawn at all times, so that inside the flat it seemed a perpetual evening. The telephones had no ringers. Instead, they were fitted with red lights that flashed to indicate incoming calls. The walls of the sitting room were hung with maps. Central Vienna, Metropolitan Vienna, Eastern Austria, Poland. On the wall opposite the windows hung a very large map of Central Europe, which showed the entire escape route, stretching from Vienna to the Baltic coast. Shamron and Gabriel had quarreled briefly over the color before settling on red. From a distance it seemed a river of blood, which is precisely how Shamron wanted it to appear, the river of blood that had flowed through the hands of Erich Radek. They spoke only German in the flat. Shamron had decreed it. Radek was referred to as Radek and only Radek. Shamron would not call him by the name he'd bought from the Americans. Shamron laid down other edicts as well. It was Gabriel's operation, and therefore it was Gabriel's show to run. It was Gabriel, in the Berlin accent of his mother, who briefed the teams, Gabriel who reviewed the watch reports from Vienna, and Gabriel, who made all final operational decisions. For the first few days, Shamron struggled to fit into his supporting role, but as his confidence in Gabriel grew, he found it easier to slide into the background. Still, every agent who passed through the safe flat took note of the dark pall that had settled over him. He seemed never to sleep. He would stand before the maps at all hours, or sit at the kitchen table in the dark, chain-smoking, like a man wrestling with a guilty conscience.
"He's like a terminal patient who's planning his own funeral," remarked Oded, a veteran German-speaking agent whom Gabriel had chosen to drive the escape car. "And if it goes to hell, they'll chisel it on his tombstone, right below the Star of David."
Under perfect circumstances, such an operation would involve weeks of planning. Gabriel had only days. The Wrath of God operation had prepared him well. The terrorists of Black September had been constantly on the move, appearing and disappearing with maddening frequency. When one was located and positively identified, the hit team would swing into action at light speed. Surveillance teams would swoop into place, vehicles and safe flats would be rented, escape routes would be planned. That reservoir of experience and knowledge served Gabriel well in Munich. Few intelligence officers knew more about rapid planning and quick strikes than he and Shamron. In the evenings, they watched the news on German television. The election in neighboring Austria had captured the attention of German viewers. Metzler was rolling forward. The crowds at his campaign stops, like his lead in the polls, grew larger by the day. Austria, it seemed, was on the verge of doing the unthinkable, electing a chancellor from the far right. Inside the Munich safe flat, Gabriel and his team found themselves in the odd position of cheering Metzler's ascent in the polls, for without Metzler, their doorway to Radek would close. Invariably, soon after the news ended, Lev would check in from Kingsall Boulevard and subject Gabriel to a tedious cross-examination of the day's events. It was the one time Shamron was relieved not to bear the burden of operational command. Gabriel would pace the floor with a phone against his ear, patiently answering each of Lev's questions. And sometimes, if the light was right, Shamron would see Gabriel's mother pacing beside him. She was the one member of the team that no one ever mentioned. Once each day, usually in late afternoon, Gabriel and Shamron escaped the safe flat to walk in the English gardens. Eichmann's shadow hung over them. Gabriel reckoned he had been there from the beginning. He had come that night in Vienna, when Max Klein had told Gabriel the story of the SS officer who had murdered a dozen prisoners at Birkenau, and now enjoyed coffee every afternoon at the Café Central. Still, Shamron had diligently avoided even speaking his name until now. Gabriel had heard the story of Eichmann's capture many times before. Indeed, Shamron had used it in September 1972 to prod Gabriel into joining the Wrath of God team. The version Shamron told during those walks along the tree-lined footpaths of the English gardens was more detailed than any Gabriel had heard before. Gabriel knew these were not merely the ramblings of an old man trying to relive past glories. Shamron was never one to trumpet his own successes, and the publishers would wait in vain for his memoirs. Gabriel knew Shamron was telling him about Eichmann for a reason.
"I've taken the journey you're about to make," Shamron was saying. "In another time, in another place, in the company of another man. But there are things you should know."
Gabriel at times could not shake the sense that he was walking with history.
"Waiting for the escape plane was the hardest part. We were trapped in the safe house with this rat of a man. Some of the team couldn't bear to look at him. I had to sit in his room, night after night, and keep watch over him. He was chained to the iron bed, dressed in pajamas with opaque goggles over his eyes. We were strictly forbidden to engage him in conversation. Only the interrogator was allowed to speak to him. I couldn't obey those orders. You see, I had to know. How had this man, who was sickened by the sight of blood, killed 6 million of my people? My mother and father, my two sisters? I asked him why he had done it.
And do you know what he said? He told me he did it because it was his job. His job, Gabriel. As if he were nothing more than a bank clerk or a railroad conductor.
And later, standing at the balustrade of a humpbacked bridge overlooking a stream.
Only once did I want to kill him, Gabriel. When he tried to tell me that he did not hate the Jewish people, that he actually liked and admired the Jewish people. To show me how much he cared for the Jews, he began to recite our words. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. I could not bear to hear those words coming out of that mouth, the mouth that had given the orders to murder 6 million. I clamped my hand over his face until he shut up. He began to shake and convulse. I thought I'd caused him to have a heart attack. He asked me if I was going to kill him. He pleaded with me not to harm his son. This man, who had torn children from the arms of their parents and thrown them into the fire, was concerned about his own child, as if we would act like him, as if we would murder children.
And at a scarred wooden table in a deserted beer garden.
We wanted him to agree to return with us, voluntarily, to Israel. He, of course, did not want to go. He wanted to stand trial in Argentina or Germany. I told him this was not possible. One way or another, he was going to stand trial in Israel. I risked my career by allowing him to have a bit of red wine and a cigarette. I did not drink with the murderer. I could not. I assured him that he would be given a chance to tell his side of the story, that he would be given a proper trial with a proper defense. He was under no illusions about the outcome, but the notion of explaining himself to the world somehow appealed to him. I also pointed out the fact that he would have the dignity of knowing he was about to die, something he denied to the millions who marched into the disrobing rooms and the gas chambers while Max Klein serenaded them. He signed the paper, dated it like a good German bureaucrat, and it was done.
Gabriel listened intently, his coat collar around his ears, his hands crammed into his pockets. Shamron shifted the focus from Adolf Eichmann to Erich Radek.
You have an advantage, because you've seen him face to face once already, at the Café Central. I'd seen Eichmann only from afar, while we were watching his house and planning the snatch. But I had never actually spoken to him, or even stood next to him. I knew exactly how tall he was, but couldn't picture it. I had a sense of how his voice would sound, but I didn't really know. You know, Radek, but unfortunately he knows a bit about you too, thanks to Manfred Cruz. He will want to know more. He'll feel exposed and vulnerable. He'll try to level the playing field by asking you questions. He'll want to know why you are pursuing him. Under no circumstances are you to engage him in anything like normal conversation. Remember, Erich Radek was no camp guard or gas chamber operator. He was SD, a skilled interrogator. He'll try to bring those skills to bear one final time to avoid his fate. Don't play into his hands. You're the one in charge now. He'll find the reversal a shock to the system.
Gabriel cast his eyes downward as if he were reading the words carved into the table. So why do Eichmann and Radek deserve the trappings of justice? He said finally, but the Palestinians from Black September only vengeance.
You would have made a fine Talmudic scholar, Gabriel, and you're avoiding my question. Obviously, there was a measure of pure vengeance in our decision to target the Black September terrorists. But it was more than that. They posed a continuing threat. If we didn't kill them, they would kill us. It was war.
Why not arrest them? Put them on trial?
So they could spout their propaganda from an Israeli court?
Shamron shook his head slowly.
They already did that.
He raised his hand and pointed to the tower rising over the Olympic Park.
Right here, in this city, in front of all the world's cameras. It wasn't our job to give them another opportunity to justify the massacre of innocents.
He lowered his hand and leaned across the table. It was then that he told Gabriel of the Prime Minister's wishes. His breath froze before him as he spoke.
"I don't want to kill an old man," Gabriel said. "He's not an old man. He wears an old man's clothing and hides behind an old man's face. But he's still Erich Radek, the monster who killed a dozen men at Auschwitz because they couldn't identify a piece of Brahms. The monster who killed two girls by the side of a Polish road because they wouldn't deny the atrocities of Birkenau. The monster who opened the graves of millions and subjected their corpses to one final humiliation. Infirmity does not forgive such sins."
Gabriel looked up and held Shamron's insistent gaze.
"I know he's a monster. I just don't want to kill him. I want the world to know what this man did."
"Then you'd better be ready to do battle with him."
Shamron glared at his wristwatch.
"I'm bringing in someone to help you prepare. In fact, he should be arriving shortly."
"Why am I being told about this now? I thought I was the one making all the operational decisions."
"You are," Shamron said. "But sometimes I have to show you the way. That's what old men are for."
Neither Gabriel nor Shamron believed in harbingers or omens. If they had, the operation that brought Moshe Rivlin from Yad Vashem to the safe house in Munich would have cast doubt on the team's ability to carry out the task before them. Shamron wanted Rivlin approached quietly. Unfortunately, King Saul Boulevard entrusted the job to a pair of apprentices fresh from the academy, both markedly Sephardic in appearance. They decided to contact Rivlin while he walked home from Yad Vashem to his apartment near the Yehuda Market. Rivlin, who had grown up in the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn and was still vigilant when walking the streets, quickly noticed that he was being followed by two men in a car. He assumed them to be Hamas suicide bombers or a pair of street criminals. When the car pulled alongside him and the passenger asked for a word, Rivlin broke into a lopsided run. To everyone's surprise, the tubby archivist proved himself to be an elusive prey, and he evaded his captors for several minutes before finally being cornered by the two office agents in Ben Yehuda Street. He arrived at the safe flat in Lahel late that evening, bearing two suitcases filled with research material and a chip on his shoulder over the way his summons had been handled.
"How do you expect to snatch a man like Erich Radek if you can't grab one fat archivist?"
"Come on," he said, pulling Gabriel into the privacy of the back bedroom.
"We have a lot of ground to cover, and not much time to do it."
On the seventh day, Adrian Carter came to Munich. It was a Wednesday. He arrived at the safe flat in the late afternoon, as the dusk was turning to dark. The passport in the pocket of his Burberry overcoat still said Brad Cantwell. Gabriel and Shamron were just returning from an outing in the English Gardens, and were bundled in their hats and scarves. Gabriel had dispatched the rest of the team members to their final staging positions, so the safe flat was empty of office personnel. Only Rivlin remained. He greeted the deputy director of the CIA with his shirt tail out and his shoes off, and called himself Yakov. The archivist had adapted well to the discipline of the operation. Gabriel made the tea. Carter unbuttoned his coat and led himself on a preoccupied tour of the flat. He spent a long time in front of the maps. Carter believed in maps. Maps never lied to you. Maps never told you what they thought you wanted to hear.
"I like what you've done with the place, Herr Heller."
Carter finally removed his overcoat.
"Neo-contemporary squalor. And the smell. I'm sure I know it. Carry out from the Wiener Vault down the block, if I'm not mistaken."
Gabriel handed him a mug of tea with the string from the bag still dangling over the edge of the rim.
"Why are you here, Adrian?"
"I thought I'd pop over to see if I could be of help."
"Bullshit."
Carter cleared a spot on the couch and sat down heavily, a salesman at the end of a long and fruitless road trip.
"Truth be told, I'm here at the behest of my director.
It seems he's getting a serious case of pre-operative jitters. He feels we're out on a limb together, and you boys are the ones holding the chainsaw. He wants the agency to be brought into the picture. Meaning, he wants to know the game plan. You know the game plan, Adrian. I told you the game plan in Virginia. It hasn't changed. I know the broad strokes of the plan, Carter said. Now I'd like to see the fine print. What you're saying is that your director wants to review the plan and sign off on it. Something like that. He also wants me standing on the sidelines with Ari when it goes down. And if we tell him to go to hell? I'd say there's a 50-50 chance. Someone will whisper a warning in Eric Radek's ear and you'll lose him. Play ball with the director, Gabriel. It's the only way you'll get Radek. We're ready to move, Adrian. Now is not the time for helpful suggestions from the seventh floor. Shamron sat down next to Carter. If your director had an ounce of brains, he'd stay as far away from this as possible. I tried to explain that to him. Not in those terms, mind you, but something close. He'd have none of it. He came from Wall Street, our director. He likes to think of himself as a hands-on, take-charge sort of fellow. Always knew what every division of the company was doing. Tries to run the agency the same way. And as you know, he's also a friend of the president. If you cross him, he'll call the White House, and it'll be over. Gabriel looked to Shamron, who gritted his teeth and nodded. Carter got his briefing. Shamron remained seated for a few minutes, but soon he was up and pacing the room, a chef whose secret recipes are being given to a competitor up the street. When it was finished, Carter took a long time loading the bowl of his pipe with tobacco. "Sounds to me as if you gentlemen are ready," he said. "What are you waiting for? If I were you, I'd put it in motion before my hands-on director decides he wants to be part of the snatch team." Gabriel agreed. He picked up the telephone and dialed Uzi Navot in Zurich. Chapter 33. Vienna, Munich. Klaus Halder knocked softly on the door of the studio. The voice on the other side granted permission for him to enter. He pushed open the door and saw the old man seated in the half-light, his eyes fixed on the flickering screen of the television. A Metzler rally, that afternoon in Graz, adoring crowds, talk already turning to the composition of the Metzler cabinet. The old man killed the image by remote and turned his blue eyes on the bodyguard. Halder glanced toward the telephone. A green light was winking.
"Who is it?"
"Herr Becker, calling from Zurich." The old man picked up the receiver.
"Good evening, Konrad."
"Good evening, Herr Vogel. I'm sorry to bother you so late, but I'm afraid it couldn't wait."
"Is something wrong?"
"Oh, no. Quite the contrary. Given the recent election news from Vienna, I've decided to quicken the pace of my preparations and proceed as though Peter Metzler's victory is a fait accompli."
"A wise course of action, Konrad."
"I thought you'd agree. I have several documents that require your signature. I thought it would be best for us to start that process now rather than waiting until the last moment."
"What sort of documents?"
"My lawyer will be able to explain them better than I can. If it's all right with you, I'd like to come to Vienna for a meeting. It won't take more than a few minutes."
"How does Friday sound?"
"Friday would be fine, as long as it's late afternoon. I have an appointment in the morning that can't be moved."
"Shall we say 4 o'clock?
5 would be better for me, Herr Vogel."
"All right, Friday at 5 o'clock.
I'll see you then."
"Konrad?"
"Yes, Herr Vogel."
"This lawyer. Tell me his name, please."
"Oskar Langer, Herr Vogel. He's a very talented man. I've used him many times in the past."
"I assume he's a fellow who understands the meaning of the word discretion?"
"Discreet doesn't even begin to describe him. You're in very capable hands."
"Goodbye,
Conrad.
The old man hung up the phone and looked at Halder.
He's bringing someone with him?
A slow nod. He's always come alone in the past. Why is he suddenly bringing along a helper?
Herr Becker is about to receive $100 million, Klaus. If there's one man in the world we can trust, it's the gnome from Zurich.
The bodyguard moved toward the door.
Klaus?
Yes, Herr Vogel.
Perhaps you're right. Call some of our friends in Zurich. See if anyone's heard of a lawyer named Oskar Langer.
1 hour later, a recording of Becker's telephone call was sent by secure transmission from the offices of Becker and Pool in Zurich to the safe flat in Munich. They listened to it once, then again, then a third time. Adrian Carter did not like what he heard.
You realize that as soon as Radek put down the phone, he made a second phone call to Zurich to check out Oskar Langer. I hope you've accounted for that.
Shamron seemed disappointed in Carter.
What do you think, Adrian? We've never done this sort of thing before. With children who need to be shown the way?
Carter put a match to his pipe and puffed smoke, awaiting his answer.
Have you ever heard of the term Saiyan? Shamron said. Or Saiyanim.
Carter nodded with the pipe between his teeth.
You're little volunteer helpers, he said. The hotel clerks who give you rooms without checking in. The rental car agents who give you cars that can't be traced. The doctors who treat your agents when they have wounds that might raise difficult questions. The bankers who give you emergency loans.
Shamron nodded.
We're a small intelligence service. 1,200 full-time employees, that's all. We couldn't do what we do without the help of the Saiyanim. They're one of the few benefits of the diaspora, my private army of little volunteer helpers.
And Oskar Langer?
He's a Zurich tax and estate lawyer. He also happens to be Jewish. It's something that he doesn't advertise in Zurich. A few years ago, I took Oskar to dinner in a quiet little restaurant on the lake and added him to my list of helpers. Last week, I asked him for a favor. I wanted to borrow his passport and his office, and I wanted him to disappear for a couple of weeks. When I told him why, he was all too willing to help. In fact, he wanted to go to Vienna himself and help capture Radek. I hope he's in a secure location.
You might say so, Adrian. He's in a safe flat in Jerusalem at the moment.
Shamron reached down toward the tape player, pressed rewind, stop, then play.
How does Friday sound?
Friday would be fine, as long as it's late afternoon. I have an appointment in the morning that can't be moved.
Shall we say 4 o'clock?
5 would be better for me, Herr Vogel.
All right. Friday at 5 o'clock.
Stop. Moshe Rivlin left the safe flat the following morning and returned to Israel on an El Al flight, with an office minder in the seat next to him. Gabriel remained until 7 o'clock Thursday evening, when a Volkswagen van, with 2 pairs of skis mounted on the roof, pulled up outside the flat and honked its horn twice. He slipped his beretta into the waist of his trousers. Carter wished him luck. Shamron kissed his cheek and sent him down. Shamron opened the curtains and peered into the darkened street. Gabriel emerged from the passageway and went to the driver's side window. After a moment of discussion, the door opened and Chiara emerged. She walked around the front of the van and was briefly illuminated by the glow of the headlights before climbing into the passenger seat. The van eased away from the curb. Shamron followed its progress until the crimson taillights disappeared around a corner. He did not move. The waiting. Always the waiting. His lighter flared. A cloud of smoke gathered against the glass. Chapter 34. Zurich. Conrad Becker and Uzi Navot emerged from the offices of Becker and Poole at precisely 1:04 on Friday afternoon. An office watcher called Zalman, posted on the opposite side of the Talstrasse in a grey Fiat sedan, recorded the time, as well as the weather, a drenching downpour, then flashed the news to Shamron in the Munich safe flat. Becker was dressed for a funeral, in a grey pinstripe suit and charcoal-coloured tie. Navot, mimicking Oscar Langer's stylish attire, wore an Armani blazer with matching electric blue shirt and tie. Becker had ordered a taxi to take him to the airport. Shamron would have preferred a private car with an office driver, but Becker always travelled to the airport by taxi, and Gabriel wanted his routine left undisturbed. So it was an ordinary city taxi driven by a Turkish immigrant that bore them out of central Zurich and across a fog-bound river valley to Kloten Airport, with Gabriel's watcher in tow. They were soon confronted with the first glitch. A cold front had moved over Zurich, turning the rain to sleet and ice, and forcing Kloten Airport authorities to briefly suspend operations. Swiss International Airlines Flight 1578, bound for Vienna, boarded on time, then sat motionless on the tarmac. Shamron and Adrian Carter, monitoring the situation on the computers in the Munich safe flat, debated their next move. Should they instruct Becker to call Radek and warn him about the delay? What if Radek had other plans and decided to cancel the meeting and reschedule it for another time? The teams and vehicles were at final staging positions. A temporary stand-down would jeopardize operational security. Wait, counseled Shamron, and wait is what they did. By 2:30, weather conditions had improved. Kloten reopened and Flight 1578 took its place in the queue at the end of the runway. Shamron made the calculations. The flight to Vienna took less than 90 minutes. If they got off the ground soon, they could still make it to Vienna in time. At 2:45, the plane was airborne, and disaster was averted. Shamron flashed the reception team at Schwechat Airport in Vienna that their package was on its way. The storm over the Alps made the flight to Vienna a good deal more turbulent than Becker would have preferred. To settle his nerves, he consumed 3 miniature bottles of Stolichnaya and visited the toilet twice, all of which was recorded by Zalman, who was seated 3 rows behind. Navot, a picture of concentration and serenity, stared out the window at the sea of black cloud, his sparkling water untouched. They touched down at Schwechat a few minutes after 4 o'clock in a dirty grey twilight. Zalman shadowed them through the terminal toward passport control. Becker made 1 more visit to the toilet. Navot, with an almost imperceptible movement of his eyes, commanded Zalman to go with him. After availing himself of the facilities, the banker spent 3 minutes primping in front of the mirror, an inordinate amount of time, thought Zalman, for a man with virtually no hair. The watcher considered giving Becker a kick in the ankle to move him along, then decided to let him have the reins instead. He was, after all, an amateur, acting under duress. After clearing passport control, Becker and Navot made their way into the arrivals hall. There, standing amid the crowds, was a tall, reedy surveillance specialist called Mordecai. He wore a drab, black suit and held a cardboard sign that read, Bauer. His car, a large, black Mercedes sedan, was waiting in short-term parking. 2 spaces away was a silver Audi hatchback. The keys were in Zalman's pocket. Zalman gave them a wide berth during the drive into Vienna. He dialed the Munich safe flat, and with a few carefully chosen words, let Shamron know that Navot and Becker were on time and proceeding toward the target. By 4:45, Mordecai had reached the Danube Canal. By 4:50, he had crossed the line into the first district, and was making his way through the rush-hour traffic along the Ringstrasse. He turned right into a narrow cobblestone street, then made the first left. A moment later he drew to a stop in front of Erich Radek's ornate iron gate. Zalman slipped past on the left and kept driving. "Flash the lights," Becker said, "and the bodyguard will admit you." Mordecai did as he was told. The gate remained motionless for several tense seconds. Then there was a sharp metallic clank, followed by the grind of a motor engaging. As the gate swung slowly open, Radek's bodyguard appeared at the front door, the intense light of a chandelier blazing around his head and shoulders like a halo. Mordecai waited until the gate was fully open, before easing forward into the small horseshoe drive. Navot climbed out first, then Becker. The banker shook the bodyguard's hand and introduced, "My associate from Zurich, Herr Oscar Langer." The bodyguard nodded and gestured for them to come inside. The front door closed. Mordecai looked at his watch. 4:58. He picked up his cell phone and dialed a Vienna number.
"I'm going to be late for dinner," he said. "Is everything all right?"
"Yes," he said. "Everything's fine." A few seconds later, in Munich, the signal flashed across Shamron's computer screen. Shamron looked at his watch.
"How long are you going to give them?" Carter asked.
5 minutes, Shamron said, and not a second more.
The black Audi sedan, with a tall antenna mounted to the trunk, was parked a few streets over. Zalman pulled in behind it, then climbed out and walked to the passenger door. Oded was seated behind the wheel, a compact man with soft brown eyes and a pugilist's flattened nose. Zalman, settling in next to him, could smell tension on his breath. Zalman had had the advantage of activity that afternoon. Oded had been trapped in the Vienna safe flat with nothing to do but daydream about the consequences of failure. A cell phone lay on the seat, the connection already open to Munich. Zalman could hear Shamron's steady breathing. A picture formed in his mind. A younger version of Shamron marching through a drenching Argentine rain, Eichmann stepping off a city bus and walking toward him from the opposite direction. Oded started the car engine. Zalman was hauled back to the present. He glanced at the dashboard clock. 5:03. The E461, better known to Austrians as the Brunnerstrasse, is a two-lane road that runs north from Vienna through the rolling hills of the Weinviertel, Austria's wine country. It is 50 miles to the Czech border. There is a crossing, sheltered by a high, arching canopy, usually manned by two guards who are reluctant to leave the comfort of their aluminum and glass hut to carry out even the most cursory inspection of outgoing vehicles. On the Czech side of the crossing, the examination of travel documents typically takes a bit longer, though traffic from Austria is generally welcomed with open arms. 1 mile across the border, anchored to the hills of South Moravia, stands the ancient town of Mikulov. It is a border town, with a border town siege mentality. It suited Gabriel's mood. He stood behind the brick parapet of a medieval castle, high above the red tile roofs of the old city beneath a pair of wind-bent pine. The cold rain beaded like tears on the surface of his oilskin coat. His gaze was down the hillside toward the border. In the blackness, only the lights of the traffic along the highway were visible, white lights rising toward him, red lights receding toward the Austrian border. He looked at his watch. They would be inside Radek's villa now. Gabriel could picture briefcases opening, coffee and drinks being poured, and then another image appeared, a line of women dressed in grey, making their way along a snowy road drenched in blood, his mother shedding tears of ice.
"What will you tell your child about the war, Jew?"
"The truth, Herr Sturmbahnführer. I'll tell my child the truth."
"No one will believe you."
She had not told him the truth, of course. Instead, she had set the truth to paper and locked it away in the file rooms of Yad Vashem. Perhaps Yad Vashem was the best place for it. Perhaps there are some truths so appalling they are better left confined to an archive of horrors, quarantined from the uninfected. She had been unable to tell him she was Radek's victim, just as Gabriel could never tell her he was Shamron's executioner. She always knew, though. She knew the face of death, and she had seen death in Gabriel's eyes. The telephone in his coat pocket vibrated silently against his hip. He brought it slowly to his ear and heard the voice of Shamron. He dropped the telephone into his pocket and stood for a moment, watching the headlights floating toward him across the black Austrian plain.
"What will you say to him when you see him?" Chiara had asked.
"The truth," Gabriel thought now. "I'll tell him the truth."
He started walking down the narrow stone streets of the ancient town into the darkness. Chapter 35. Vienna. Uzi Nevots knew a thing or two about body searches. Klaus Halder was very good at his job. He started with Nevots' shirt collar and ended with the cuffs of his Armani trousers. Next he turned his attention to the attaché case. He worked slowly, like a man with all the time in the world, and with a monkish attention to detail. When the search was finally over, he straightened the contents carefully and snapped the latches back into place. "Herr Vogel will see you now," he said. "Follow me, please." They walked the length of the central corridor, then passed through a pair of double doors and entered a drawing room. Erich Radek, in a herringbone jacket and rust-colored tie, was seated near the fireplace. He acknowledged his guests with a single nod of his narrow head, but made no attempt to rise. Radek, Navot gathered, was a man used to receiving visitors seated. The bodyguard slipped quietly from the room and closed the doors behind him. Becker, smiling, stepped forward and shook Radek's hand. Navot did not wish to touch the murderer, but given the circumstances, he had no choice. The proffered hand was cool and dry, the grip firm and without a tremor. It was a testing handshake. Navot sensed that he had passed. Radek flicked his fingers toward the empty chairs, then his hand returned to the drink resting on the arm of his chair. He began twisting it back and forth, two twists to the right, two to the left. Something about the movement made acid pour into Navot's stomach.
"I hear very good things about your work, Herr Langer," Radek said suddenly. "You have a fine reputation among your colleagues in Zurich."
"All lies, I assure you, Herr Vogel."
"You're too modest." He twisted his drink. "You did some work for a friend of mine a few years back, a gentleman named Helmut Schneider."
"And you're trying to lead me into a trap,"
thought Navot. He had prepared himself for a ploy like this. The real Oskar Langer had provided a list of his clients for the last 10 years for Navot to memorize. The name Helmut Schneider had not appeared on it. "I've handled a good many clients over the last few years, but I'm afraid the name Schneider was not among them. Perhaps your friend has me confused with someone else." Navot looked down, opened the latches of his attaché case, and lifted the lid. When he looked up again, Radek's blue eyes were boring into his, and his drink was rotating on the arm of the chair. There was a frightening stillness about his eyes. It was like being studied by a portrait.
"Perhaps you're right."
Radek's conciliatory tone did not match his expression. "Konrad said you required my signature on some documents concerning the liquidation of the assets in the account."
"Yes, that's correct."
Navot removed a file from his attaché and placed the attaché on the floor at his feet. Radek followed the progress of the briefcase downward, then returned his gaze to Navot's face. Navot lifted the lid of the file folder and looked up. He opened his mouth to speak, but was interrupted by the ringing of the telephone. Sharp and electronic, it sounded to Navot's sensitive ears like a scream in a cemetery. Radek made no movement. Navot glanced toward the Biedermeier desk, and the telephone rang a second time. It started to ring a third time, then went suddenly silent, as though it had been muzzled mid-scream. Navot could hear Halder, the bodyguard, speaking on an extension in the corridor.
"Good evening. No, I'm sorry, but Herr Vogel is in a meeting at the moment."
Navot removed the first document from the file. Radek was now visibly distracted, his gaze distant. He was listening to the sound of his bodyguard's voice. Navot inched forward in his chair and held the paper at an angle so Radek could see it. "This is the first document that requires..." Radek lifted his hand, demanding silence. Navot heard footfalls in the corridor, followed by the sound of the doors opening. The bodyguard stepped into the room and walked to Radek's side.
"It's Manfred Kruse," he said in a chapel murmur. "He'd like a word. He says it's urgent and can't wait."
Erich Radek rose slowly from his chair and walked to the telephone.
"What is it, Manfred?"
"The Israelis."
"What about them?"
"I have intelligence to suggest that during the past few days, a large team of operatives has assembled in Vienna in order to kidnap you."
"How certain are you of your intelligence?"
"Certain enough to conclude it's no longer safe for you to remain in your home. I've dispatched a Staatspolizei unit to collect you and take you to a safe location."
"No one can get inside here, Manfred.
Just put an armed guard outside the house. We're dealing with the Israelis, Herr Vogel. I want you out of the house.
All right, if you insist. But tell your unit to stand down. Klaus can handle it.
One bodyguard isn't enough. I'm responsible for your security, and I want you under police protection. I'm afraid I have to insist. The intelligence I have is very specific.
When will your officers be here?
Any minute. Get ready to move.
He hung up the telephone and looked at the two men seated next to the fire.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I'm afraid I have something of an emergency. We'll have to finish this another time.
He turned to his bodyguard. Open the gates, Klaus, and get me a coat.
Now.
The motors of the front gates engaged. Mordecai, seated behind the wheel of the Mercedes, looked into his rearview mirror and saw a car turning into the drive from the street, a blue light whirling on the dash. It pulled up behind him and braked hard. Two men piled out and bounded up the front steps. Mordecai reached down and slowly turned the ignition. Erich Radek went into the corridor. Nevot packed his attaché case and stood. Becker remained frozen in place. Nevot hooked his fingers beneath the banker's armpit and lifted him to his feet. They followed Radek into the corridor. Blue emergency lights flashed across the walls and ceilings. Radek was next to his bodyguard, speaking quietly into his ear. The bodyguard was holding an overcoat and looked tense. As he helped Radek into the coat, his eyes were on Nevot. There was a knock at the door, two sharp reports that echoed from the high ceiling and marble floor of the corridor. The bodyguard released Radek's overcoat and turned the latch. Two men in plain clothes pushed past and entered the house.
"Are you ready, Herr Vogel?"
Radek nodded, then turned and looked once more at Nevot and Becker.
"Again, please accept my apologies, gentlemen. I'm terribly sorry for the inconvenience."
Radek turned toward the door, Klaus at his shoulder. One of the officers blocked his path and put a hand on the bodyguard's chest. The bodyguard swatted it away.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Herr Cruz gave us very specific instructions. We were to take only Herr Vogel into protective custody."
"Cruz would never have given an order like that. He knows that I go wherever he goes. That's the way it's always been."
"I'm sorry, but those were our orders."
"Let me see your badge and identification."
"There isn't time. Please, Herr Vogel, come with us."
The bodyguard took a step back and reached inside his jacket. As the gun came into view, Nevot lunged forward. With his left hand, he seized the bodyguard's wrist and pinned the gun against his abdomen. With his right, he delivered two vicious, open-handed blows to the back of the neck. The first blow staggered Hulda. The second caused his knees to buckle. His hand relaxed, and the Glock clattered to the marble floor. Radek looked at the gun and for an instant thought about trying to pick it up. Instead, he turned and lunged toward the open door of his study and slammed it shut. Nevot tried the latch. Locked. He took a few steps back and drove his shoulder into the door. The wood splintered, and he tumbled into the darkened room. He scrambled to his feet and saw that Radek had already moved away the false front of a bookcase and was standing inside a small phone booth-sized lift. Nevot sprang forward as the elevator door started to close. He managed to get both his arms inside and grab Radek by the lapels of his overcoat. As the door slammed against Nevot's left shoulder, Radek seized his wrists and tried to break free. Nevot held firm. Odeddin Zalman came to his aid. Zalman, the taller of the two, reached over Nevot's head and pulled against the door. Oded slithered between Nevot's legs and applied pressure from below. Under the onslaught, the door finally slid open again. Nevot dragged Radek out of the elevator. There was no time for subterfuge or deception now. Nevot clamped a hand over the old man's mouth. Zalman took hold of his legs and lifted him off the floor. Oded found the light switch and doused the chandelier. Nevot glanced at Becker.
"Get in the car. Move, you idiot."
They bundled Radek down the steps toward the Audi. Radek was pulling at Nevot's hand, trying to break the vice grip over his mouth and kicking hard with his legs. Nevot could hear Zalman swearing under his breath. Somehow, even in the heat of battle, he managed to swear in German. Oded threw open the rear door before running around the back of the car and climbing behind the wheel. Nevot pushed Radek headfirst into the back and pinned him to the seat. Zalman forced his way inside and closed the door. Becker climbed into the back of the Mercedes. Mordecai accelerated hard, and the car lurched into the street, the Audi following closely. Roddick's body went suddenly still. Nevot removed his hand from Roddick's mouth, and the Austrian gulped greedily of the air.
"You're hurting me," he said. "I can't breathe."
"I'll let you up, but you have to promise to behave yourself. No more escape attempts. Do you promise?"
"Just let me up. You're crushing me, you fool."
"I will, old man. Just do me a favor first. Tell me your name, please."
"You know my name. My name is Vogel, Ludwig Vogel."
"No, no, not that name. Your real name."
"That is my real name."
"Do you want to sit up and leave Vienna like a man, or am I going to have to sit on you the whole way?"
"I want to sit up. You're hurting me, damn it."
"Just tell me your name." He was silent for a moment. Then he murmured,
"My name is Radek."
"I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you. Can you say your name again, please? Loudly, this time?"
He drew a deep breath of air, and his body went rigid, as though he were standing at attention instead of lying across the back seat of a car.
"My name is Sturmbannführer Erich Radek."
In the Munich safe flat, the message flashed across Shamron's computer screen. "Package has been received." Carter clapped him on the back.
"I'll be goddamn, they got him. They actually got him."
Shamron stood and walked to the map.
"Getting him was always the easiest part of the operation, Adrian. Getting him out is quite another thing."
He gazed at the map. 50 miles to the Czech border.
"Drive, Oded,"
he thought.
"Drive like you've never driven before in your life."
End of Disc 8.